together as Kolya and Makovsky rode on. The savagery of their slaying seemed to increase correspondingly. These Kurgan had seen the brutality of death before it found them, and not all of them were dead. There were at least two men writhing about that Kolya could see, viscera-soaked and wailing like newborns. Makovsky spat on a dying Northman's forehead. Kolya shuddered, clutching at Kostanka's mane. Chaos had come to the Oblast. Not its armies, they had been and passed, but chaos itself, the essence of it, the time of changes. Kolya could feel it in his bowels, and somewhere in that clangor of combat, the blood god was laughing.
"Enough, Boris," Kolya murmured.
Through the blizzard, he could just make out the battle ahead. Grey figures, both mounted and on foot, swirled through the snow. Horses brayed. Screams, disconnected to any obvious living thing, were birthed, beaten bloody, and then buried under shadow-play swipes of wood and steel. The business of calming Kostanka's nerves left Kolya no room to notice his own. He had been resigned to this fate since before the Tobol crossing. Kislev was the land, and the land was beaten. His family in Dushaika had mourned him when he had ridden out with the Rota, but he had not thought to mourn for them, and had likely outlived them all. But now that his moment was here, he found that this headless chicken was not yet ready to stop running. He didn't bother to pray. When a fool prayed to Urson, it was his own arm that got bitten. Instead, he filled his lungs and issued the war cry of Dushaika. Stefan would know what it meant.
Dzień dobry,
said Makovsky with a wild smile. It meant goodbye, or alternatively, die well. Kolya supposed that it did not matter. Both men noted the crest of orange hair that emerged from the grey of the melee, though neither gave it any mind as they kicked in their spurs and charged.
Pull it. Do it fast.
Stefan Taksak gripped the pommel of his saddle, the kvass still hot in his mouth, as the lancer tightened his grip around the brush of fletching sticking out of his shoulder. Stefan tensed against the pain but didn't cry out. That had come earlier, when the two men had removed pauldron, beaver, and rear brace, and wielded knives to his leather akaton and furs to expose the wound to the cold. Worse was coming. The shaft was lodged in his guard brace, but the head had not gone far enough through the bone to penetrate the back of the piece. There was no way to remove the plate. The arrow would have to come out the same way it had gone in. The lancer teased the shaft to unfasten it from the bone. Stefan's chest heaved and he pulled back, but the second man had his horse beside him, an arm tight around his waist. A wooden cup appeared at his lips, and kvass spilled down his chin. His shoulder felt as if it were being levered from his neck. He screamed through his teeth,
"Faster than that, damn it!"
With a spurt of blood and a shredding pain, the shaft came free. Stefan slumped against Biergatz's neck, and there he shuddered. Again that wooden cup appeared before him, but this time he found the strength to turn it away. There was a battle still to be fought, and he'd already drunk more than his share. With trembling fingers, he picked at the strappings of his guard brace and let the piece fall. After the pain, he felt hollow, as if this was a dream or he had just been woken from one. With a hiss, he hoisted his left arm so it lay across the saddle and his hand could grip the pommel. The lancer with bloodied fingers, a short man with a snow leopard pelt over his shoulder, took Biergatz's reins, but Stefan warned him off, then sat up and handed the lancer his Zalbla, so he could handle his own reins.
"I am a Marzalek of Kislev. I will not have my own horse led for me."
Meanwhile, the second lancer, an older rider in cunningly filigreed but painfully dented three-quarter plate, swung down from the saddle and set about recovering the discarded pieces of Stefan's armour. The sight of it, the pride, wealth, and beauty of Dushaika just lying there, turned his stomach and made his shoulder throb anew. He said nothing, though, merely grunted gratitude as the man secured it amongst Birgat's saddlebags. As long as Herr Rota wore it with courage, then Kislev lived.
Did you hear that, Mazalek?
A shrill cry carried through the snow, and the dulled murmur of distant battle. The cry of a chimera. Stefan mouthed a prayer for his brother. And for Kislev. Kolya and Makovsky charged into the hated Kurgan. There was no cohesion to the Kurgan's ranks, and the two lancers punched through, men falling under their hooves like so many Matryoshka dolls. Their wings wailed like dying men. Kolya belted out his war cry as he lashed out with his palads. The huge blade was for stabbing rather than slicing. It had no cutting edge, and without the power of a charge was essentially a 6-foot steel mallet. A Northman with a bearskin cloak and a flail staggered into range, dazed, blood streaming down his face from the backswing of Makoski's Nadziak. Kolya hacked his palads across the man's skull, then parried a groin stab from an adze. He jawed the marauder with a booted stirrup, and with a shift of weight and a yell, bade Kostanka to sidestep into the man, trampling him and throwing down those beside him. He was getting bogged down, but through sheer force of will and ferocity, Makovsky had driven himself a horse length ahead.
Back!
Kolya yelled. They were too lightly armoured to survive a melee, and their weapons were not designed for that style of attritional combat. He slid his weight back across the saddle and drew on the reins. Kostanka whinnied in fright, trailing coloured ribbons like a prize mare to market, as she tried to turn through the raging crush of Northmen.
Withdraw and charge again!
But Makovsky was not listening. His Nadziak tore a fistful of blood from a Kurgan's face and cast it over the melee. His horse managed another step.
The blood of Kislev returns for you, demon!
The press before the former trapper thinned. The Kurgan fought with a demented savagery, like rats fleeing a burning tursa, but Makovsky forced his horse in and threw them. And then Kolya saw it. The killer that passed Rasputitsa on its own road of blood and looked in no mood to be halted now. Its look was one of stony-faced barbarity, so accustomed to slaughter and pain that it felt neither the dead that piled around its feet nor the blades that found their way past its enormous axe. The glowing light of viscera-red runes only made the weapon look even more hellish than it already was. The fighter slammed the flat of that axe into the legs of the marauder beside him. Both knees shattered, the man's face becoming a rictus roar as a cannonball fist crushed his groin, doubling him over and hurling him back. Its hard face was crossed with brutal tattoos. One eye was covered with a patch. Its orange crest of hair was torn, its bare torso covered in cuts, old and new. It was a dwarf. Kolya's mind whirled, the dwarf's axe moving so fast it defied the injunction to be in one place at one time. Kolya might have thought it some runic illusion but for the death it reaped. A Northman in blue-painted leather armour raised his twin swords in warding as the dwarf's aura of steel came upon him. The man fell apart like butcher's cuts. The dwarf's one eye was a cut gem of fury. It no longer recognised friend from foe.
Boris, stop!
Too late. The dwarf ducked the swing of Makoski's Nadziak and the charge of his horse, and, with such casualness that he seemed to be fighting through something thinner than air while all around him laboured, swung back with his axe to tear out the lancer's entire right side between hip and ribs. Blood fanned from the wound. The horse charged on until Makoski went down like a felled tree.
Gospoda!
Kolya roared, thumping his breastplate for emphasis as the dwarf came on. It was still too tight for Kostanka to turn. In panic, he had her sidestep away. The dwarf's axe cut through a spear-armed marauder, then wove around his falling body to strike at Kolya. Kostanka reared, spooked by the blood reek of him, and the dwarf's axe clove through her fetlock instead of Kolya's knee joint. Screaming, she made a three-legged jerk backwards, thrashing her bleeding stump until, unbalanced and terrified, she fell chin forward into the snow. Holding her to the end, when he might have jumped clear, Kolya went down with her. His cuisse buckled around his thigh, but did not break. His feathered harness snapped and jackknifed over him as the side of his helm hit the back of a fallen Kurgan's adze. He felt none of it, but his heart cried with hurt as he drew his leg out from beneath the struggling horse. She kicked once more, and then she, whom he had loved since she was a foal, she who had so often been brave when tormented by wicked spirits, was at peace. Weeping tears of rage, Collier swept up the adze that he had landed on. It was an unfamiliar weapon, a long wooden haft with a curved blade at the top. It could have been a rock, and he would have blessed Urson for its delivery. Hatred filled him, made him so hot that his skull buzzed with it. All that he had persevered for, through devastation and damnation, had been taken away. His stinging eyes found the dwarf. Let every spirit that had ever plagued Kostanka know. He would have blood for this.
What is this?
Stefan Taksak stared around the Kurgan camp in disbelief. Surrounding a fire pit and the bodies of the handful of guards the Northmen had thought sufficient to defend it from an impassable and already conquered steppe, was a half-ring of wagons. There were five of them in all, open rear sections turned into unroofed cages by hammering long spears point down into the boards. Furs had been draped over the outer side of the cages to protect the occupants from the worst of the wind and snow. That in itself was reason for confusion. The Kurgan would not treat even their own wounded with such consideration. But it was those occupants that dragged open his jaw. A boy, in the torn vestments of an initiate of the cult of Daz, lay apparently sleeping in the corner of one, beside the hooded and trembling figure of what appeared to be a cave goblin shaman. There was an ogre firebelly, sitting alone in a wagon filled with the chewed bones of what might once have been five or six other men. There was another goblin, a beast man, Bray Shaman, a mutant sorcerer, college men from the south with foul-smelling robes and haggard beards. Stefan mumbled an oath to Urson. The Shirokish wise woman had been but one of many. This warband had been pillaging sorcerers and scholars from all over Kislev, even stealing from their own and carrying them north. Why? What awaited them there?
The King of Prague, Maslig.
A hunchback old crone, with ice-white hair pinned with a glittering jet-spider brooch, crouched by the bars of the wagon that she shared with the cave goblin and the initiate of Daz. It stank of excrement, but the filth did not seem to touch her. Her layered skirts were of black silk. The curve of her spine gave her the appearance of a hunting insect, an impression compounded by the glittering, almost faceted eyes that peered out from their ancient web of lines. The way those eyes pierced him was a reminder of why even the Ungol shunned and revered their wise women in equal measure. Theirs was the power to perceive taint in all its hidden forms. Small wonder, then, that Kolya and Makoski had been so keen to put themselves out of sight and out of mind.
Mazena,
Stefan murmured, averting his eyes from the hag's stare. He had the itching sense that judgments were being passed on his soul.
Forgive me, wise woman, that I do not show greater respect. I fear that if I dismount, I will not be able to climb back up.
The wise woman cackled.
Do I look like a Tsarina to you, Stefan Taksak? Is the weakness of your body all you can think of? Has it been so long that you have forgotten to heed the words of your wise woman?
No,
said Stefan, quickly signalling to his two lancers to find a way to get the hag out. There was no obvious gate in the wall of spears. The goblin shifted to the far side as one of them picked up a fallen battle axe and tested its edge.
Forgive me again, Mazin, but Prague does not have a king.
You could once both wield a blade and guide a horse. This is the time of changes. Does denying it let you raise your arm again?
Stefan shook his head.
Hurry then and free me. It is not you that the spirit showed to me.
We have pursued you all the way from Uvetsin.
Marzena gave a Delphic smile of daggered teeth.
Did you think you were the only one?
Collier pushed through the press of Northmen. Just one more screaming warrior in the churn, and swung his stolen adze for the dwarf's head. The dwarf smashed an axeman's shin with a single kick, rolled from the stab of a horseman's spear, and met Kolya's adze mid-stroke. On colliding with the dwarf's rune axe, his primitive weapon simply shattered. Bits of iron flew from the useless haft of wood before Kolya could throw it down and stagger back, his buckled cuisse refusing to bend properly at the knee. A Kurgan berserker saved his life, charging into the dwarf's path with a short spear. His life ended with a tearing of meat and a bone shudder. Kolya ducked behind the man and bent to take the axe from the warrior with the broken shin, just as the dwarf ripped his rune axe from his enemy's gut and kicked the dead man aside. Kolya dragged a northman between them and shoved him into the dwarf's path. The man practically fell onto the dwarf's rune axe, and Kolya swung for the dwarf's temple while it was stuck in the marauder's belly. The dwarf was quick, though. Too quick for one so huge. He tilted back his thick trunk of a neck, Kolya's axe shaving the bloodstains from his beard, merely grazing his temple, and instead slicing through the thong that secured his eye patch. The scale of black leather flapped to the ground to be trod into the mire by a Kurgan warrior who was mercilessly hacked open. The dwarf clapped his hand to his gaping socket and roared like a bull. Kolya chuckled blackly, spinning his axe until it hummed. He favoured the axe no more than the adze, but in his wanderings he had been forced to defend himself against worse with less.
"I have fought your kind on the plains of Zar, dwarf. I do not fear you."
Muscles flowing like plates of molten rock, the dwarf charged. The rune axe struck Kolya's blade like a boulder from a catapult and threw him a foot through the air with a titanic clang of metal. He stumbled, ears and fingers ringing in tune, holding onto his wits only just enough to dodge the follow-up that would have severed his elbow had he been a second slower. Kolya ducked and spun low, sweeping for the dwarf's ankles. The dwarf jumped the blade, landed his lagging foot on the axe, then kicked Kolya hard enough across the jaw to shatter half the teeth on that side. For a second it felt as though his neck was going to tear away from his shoulders, but then the rest of his body screwed into the air and he was sent piling into a group of Kurgan warriors. That seemed to be enough for the Northmen. They had just seen one dwarf demolish their warband and a rota of Kislevite lancers at the same time, and they did not like it one bit. One by one, they began to break and run. Kolya pulled off his helm and spat out teeth, searching through the blood and guts for another weapon. By the stinking remains of a Kurgan horse, he found a bow, and after rolling over it to put its bulk between him and the dwarf, a quiver. The fletches were globbed with blood, but they would not have to fly far. Retreating, he notched a shaft of the bow and drew back. It was a horse archer's bow, a composite recurve of maple horn and sinew, designed to pack maximum power into something that could be fired from horseback. It was still less powerful than a proper longbow or crossbow, but more than enough to drop a dwarf at 10 paces. The dwarf jumped onto the horse's flank, and Kolya loosed. The arrow punched the dwarf's chest, the force pushing the dwarf's shoulder around to the left, but did no more obvious damage than that. Cursing, Kolya knocked a fresh arrow, drew and fired again. Again the arrowhead thumped into the iron of the dwarf's pectoral muscle. The dwarf's bruised lip curled into a sneer as he jumped down from the horse. Snarling, blinded to the fur-clad men in full flight all around by his hunger for vengeance, Kolya prepared a third arrow. This one he aimed right between the dwarf's eyes. He drew back until the recurved ends groaned and his fingers shook with the strain.
"Slug this off, you murderous dastard!"
"Kolya! You will hold!"
The sound of his name on a harsh woman's croak made him flinch. His fingertips trembled on the bowstring. He didn't release it, but nor did he lower it. The dwarf leered, but he too did not move, as if Kolya's arrow had him pinned. Instead, he ran his thumb down the blade of his axe until it bled. Kolya met the dwarf's stare, fire on rock. Acid burned inside his arm. His fingers were numb. He would do it. He would do it now.
"Do as you are told, child,"
spat the hag again.
"Please, brother,"
Stefan's voice.
"It is Mazena. The way she says. Can you not see it is a dwarf?
This is not a dwarf,
Kolya growled. It is a fiend from the frozen depths of the wastes.
With his one baleful eye, the dwarf glared. Blood trickled from the gaping socket of the other, and suddenly Kolya could match it no longer. With a distraught cry, he let his arm drop and loosed his shot into the ground. The dwarf just grunted. Snorting in disgust, Bigatz picked his way through the snow and into the ring of corpses. Stefan guided him with one hand on the reins. Behind him, the old crone Marzena rode side-saddle in a nest of black skirts and spiderweb hair. Kolya emptied the remainder of his quiver and dropped his bow. He had never disobeyed a wise woman since he had been a boy. The dwarf shifted his stance so that his axe could cover the three of them equally, and growled like a beast. Stefan eyed that axe warily, as well he might. It had taken more lives in the last few weeks than Kolya's brother had in a lifetime fighting greenskins and Kayazak.
I am Stefan Tegzik, he said. Marsalik of Kislev.
The dwarf grimaced, as though something had landed in his mouth and tasted foul. His axe angled indecisively between the two men. He ground his teeth until a giant blue vein bulged from his temple. Kolya wondered when the dwarf had last opened his mouth to do anything more wholesome than scream his battle cry and feast on the spoils of the slain.
I was there the day the ice palace burned, spoke the dwarf at last in 24-carat Reichsspiel.
Then he spat on the ground.
So pull the other one. There is no Kislev.
What is your name, friend?
Again the effort of dredging speech.
My name is meaningless to you, manling. If you are Kislevite, then be on your way. If you are not...
He cracked a smile full of broken and yellowed teeth, and what hint of hurt there had been in his voice was gone. He hefted his axe meaningfully.
Then my axe still thirsts.
You are lost, Slayer, said Marzena.
She silenced Stefan with a hand on the lancer's shoulder. Her words prickled the spine like prophecy, like a spider running down one's neck. The dwarf glowered, but said nothing.
As Kislev is lost, your story is that of the old world itself. With its ending comes your own, or perhaps it is the reverse. Prophecy is ever treacherous. The world cries out for a hero. For the Magnus of this age, and yet you are here. Surely you are lost.
The dwarf grunted, then shrugged.
Breaks my heart.
To Kolya's consternation and surprise, the crone smiled as though amused.
You have a destiny, Slayer, one that is known even to the spirits of my land. It was they who guided you to me. They speak to me in one voice, and of nothing but doom.
Interest glittered in the dwarf's one eye. Kolya felt his guts knot, as if they were all stood on some precipice awaiting the slightest twist of fate, a gust of wind to push them all into blackness.
If you will not go south, then go north.
Using Stefan's unwounded shoulder as a support, Marzena pointed across him, north and west.
The king of Prague gathers an army the like of which has never been seen. A host to wet the blood of any troll slayer. And I see death there. One for you, and one for your companion.
The dwarf's glower knotted tight.
I have no companion.
Perhaps that is as you see it,
murmured Marzena. But the dwarf was not listening. He planted the shoulder of his axe to his own and turned to look north.
Then just what is the king of Prague?
A favorite of the dark gods. He calls himself the Troll King, but I see no more clearly than that. He is jealous of his gifts and resentful of the spirits that would spy on him. What I know is what these dead men knew.
She waved dismissively over the fallen Kurgan.
He seeks wizards of every race and kind, and will trade them for a winter in his city. That is why warbands scour the oblast while their kin besiege the Auric Bastion.
Why does he want wizards? Said Gotrek. Narzena shrugged to indicate that she did not know.
Wise woman,
Stefan cut in while the dwarf glared thoughtfully at the crone.
This dwarf is a champion sent by Tor himself. With his aid we can hold this terse until spring. Easily.
He turned to Kolya, extended his unwounded hand, beseeching.
Tell her, brother.
Lips pursed, Kolya bent to pick up his stolen bow. His hands had left bloody prints on it. It was Kastanka's blood, and already cold.
Kislev is done. All that remains is to decide how the last of us will die. Kolya is dead. Mourned by a family that is dead.
His gaze fixed on the dwarf. The dwarf glared back.
At least this way, I will get to see the dwarf die.
For some reason, the dwarf seemed pleased.
Then it is settled,
said Marzena, silencing Stefan's protest before he could utter it. Her eyes glittered like spiders in ice.
Zien Dobri, Gotrek, son of Gurney, you will have the mightiest doom.
Part 2. War in the North. Midwinter 2524 to late winter 2525. Chapter 6. Let There Be Life. 3 weeks of lengthening nights and worsening weather saw Felix, Ulrika, and Damir arrive at Bekkafen. The state capital of Ostermark cut an impoverished picture. A mezzo-tint of grey stone walls and millet skies. Smoke sputtered from chimneys in gasping fits, the rooftops layered with white powder, seeded with the promise of Kislev's fate by the clouds that rolled over the Auric Bastion to the north. Through the snow, across the upper Talabek, the great barrier was just the glim ghost of a shimmer. But it was enough to take Felix's breath. Even from afar, its power was palpable. The three of them stayed just the one day, an arranged stop during which Felix was introduced to a succession of captains and counts, all of them half his age and as bemused by the purpose of his visit as Felix was, and whisked away to speak about his own wartime experiences at various garrison posts and inns throughout the city. He had spoken hesitantly at first, the grim stares of men who slept in the same billet as death, like lead weights on his tongue. He was a writer, not an orator, and it was painfully apparent that if any of these men had seen one of his books, they would have burned it for warmth. After a few fumbling anecdotes about his time in Prague, he grew into the role and actually started to enjoy the experience of recounting the tales of his adventuring days to rooms full of strangers who had never heard them, and whose own lives more closely paralleled his own than anyone he could meet in Otto's circles in Altdorf. Here, a rousing tale of battles against mutants and fiends on the streets of Mordheim, always a crowd-pleaser in Ostermark. There, a bawdy reminiscence of his time touring the brothels of Araby, hunting the so-called lurking horror. And come the evening, voice hoarse, Felix had the warm feeling that he might inadvertently have done some good here after all. The Ostermarkers were a hard-bitten lot, underfed and underslept, faces blighted by battle and pox. They had earned what brief smiles Felix's tales could grant them. No sooner had Felix pulled up a stool in his final venue, a tavern called the Hog's Head, and summoned the barmaid for an ale to soothe his throat, than Ulrika reappeared, and they were moving again. They beat the closure of the city's gates by minutes. 3 weeks from Altdorf to Bekkafen. With that knowledge and a map of the Empire, a man might then con himself into believing the last few dozen miles up the course of the upper Talabek, the Empire's boundary with Kislev, would be a journey of days. But arrival in Ostermark marked the drawing out of their journey, rather than its drawing in. The roads in the north had suffered the war as gracelessly as the men, and even beforehand had been poor relations to those that bore the wealthy and the powerful across the fields of Reichland and Averland. Brambles scratched at the undercarriage as if pleading to be taken away. The ruts left in the muddy track by every other preceding cart had been frozen in for the winter, to make every turn of the wheels a gambit of axle-shattering courage. More than once they found the track blocked by a fallen tree, the sort of thing one expected for the dense tangle of the griffin wood at this time of year. But on one occasion, the smashed remnants of a wagon train indicated an ambush. There were no bodies left behind, but enough hoof prints to suggest beastmen. Felix watched the tree line warily, knowing the herd that he and Cat had destroyed on the barren hills had been just one dead leaf in a forest. But nothing attacked. Nothing even moved. Felix wondered how much of that was due to Ulrika. It didn't matter who your gods were. Seeing a woman move a felled oak with her bare hands would make any would-be ambusher think twice. How armies of mere mortals could be moved under these conditions was a mystery. It took another week to travel the upper Talabek to its source in the foothills of the World's Edge Mountains, where the famed hot baths of Badenhof had once entertained nobles and royals. Time enough for a Kislevite winter to welcome Felix to the north. Felix tapped his ring on the pommel of his sword and watched the black coach rattle down Badenhof's swampy main street towards the Braden Bridge and the looming rock Talon on the eastern skyline that was Castle Rackspire. He had not been exactly heartbroken when Ulrika had suggested that she go on and announce them to Commandant Rock without him. Being alone with her in a carriage for the last month had been disconcerting. Not unpleasant, definitely not that, but confusing, as if he couldn't quite remember who or what he had been before Ulrika had come back into his life, and didn't really want to either. He was curious, though. What kind of a man, being, was this mysterious rock? And why would a man with 100 miles of battle line, the mustered strength of at least 3 provinces, and the service of the likes of Ulrika, care about the fate of one kidnapped wizard? He chuckled sourly. These were thoughts above the station of washed-up former adventurers and war poets. Right then he was simply grateful for a few hours of peace in his own head. The chill helped. Sleet blustered into the town down that east-west thoroughfare and contributed to dousing the hot coal warmth that Ulrika's nearness seemed to bring out from under his skin. He shivered, longing, and wrapped himself into his cloak. On balance, he was happy to squelch into Badenhof in ignorance. The town's old stone prosperity was braced into the confluence of 2 rivers, an unpaved and provincial-looking market square squeezed on 2 sides by the torrent of water, where the brash waters of the Braden foamed into the shoulder of the upper Talabek. A bridge of native grey stone straddled each river. The square itself was buried in sleet and snow, tracked through with footprints from Empire soldiers and displaced Cossars, hardy enough to brave the cold. What light made it through the sky's grave-dust pallor was supplemented by seepage from the shuttered windows of inns and late-closing shops. Stone-fronted and half-timbered, they closed on the other 2 sides of the square as if hoping to push it into the river. The weathered stone mass of Badenhof's famous bathhouse brooded amongst them, evocative, made somehow cruel by past glories. Huddled out of the sleet under the bathhouse's projecting 2nd story, a group of miserable-looking men in the burgundy and gold of Ostermark shared the slim warmth of a pipe. They looked like the retinue of some lord or other, left to guard the pair of monstrous destriers tethered by the entrance beside them. The horses snorted wetly, occasionally flicking their tails through the sleet. Suppressing a shudder that he couldn't explain, Felix turned from the bathhouse towards the row of tall properties that stood against the more resigned waters of the upper Talabek. After a few minutes trying to peer through boarded windows marked with the black cross of plague or the old guardian magics of hawthorn sprigs and garlic, he found what he was looking for. the wet sign that creaked above the front gate announced it as Jägers of Altdorf. Felix smiled. The provincial branches of Jäger and Sons frequently traded under that name, the allusion to the Emperor's seat carrying profitable weight in faded, out-of-the-way backwaters like Badenhof. There was no sign of a black cross. He let out a sigh of relief. That was something. Mopping his fringe from his eyes, Felix swept his cloak free of his sword arm and used his foot to nudge open the little wooden gate. It creaked inwards, and he walked to the front door. It was boarded, as were the windows. Felix tilted his head back and squinted up into the sleet. The upper story, too. He ran his hand over the boards that had been hammered over the doorframe, then put his ear against it and listened. Nothing but the white rush of the Braden. He thought about knocking, but then quietly chided himself for being an idiot. The thing was nailed down. Nobody was about to open it, were they?
Gustav!
No answer. The whole building was dead. If only Ulrika had been able to give him more details about the difficulties his nephew had managed to get himself into. It had been nearly 2 months now since Ulrika had carried Gustav's letter to Altdorf, and who knew what could have happened between now and then? For a moment, Felix wondered if Gustav could have abandoned the office altogether, perhaps relocated to the marginally safer and more salubrious company branches in Osterwald or Beckerfen, but rejected the thought out of hand. Felix knew that for a certainty, because he wouldn't have left. Gustav had inherited his grandmother's stubbornness, had confidence enough to land just the right side of arrogant, and, not unlike his old fool of an uncle, would beat his head against whatever obstacle this town could present him with until it killed him. Backing up to take a more measured look at the building, he noticed a side gate leading around the back to the riverside. He tried the latch, but it too was locked. He looked up to the top of the gate and sighed. Typical. He was getting too old to be climbing fences.
"Do you ever wonder what it is they do up there?"
said General Matthias Wilhelm von Karlsdorf, studying the hazed ring of figures within the standing stones upon the adjoining hill. Sleet pattered across his view as he scrolled his eyeglass across the stones. Men old enough to be even his grandfather stood under the rain and snow, their rich raiment of gold and pearl now sodden wet. He focused the lens on their faces. The weather had flattened their beards to their chests. Their mouths shaped a chant that the secular magic of the eyeglass made silent. Even without the words, he could feel the hairs on the insides of his ears prickle. Lowering the glass, he turned to the man beside him, giving himself as long as was politic for a brother-in-law of Ostermark's elector and a distant cousin of the House of Wilhelm to remember the fellow's name.
"Well, do you, Gunnery Sergeant?"
Sheltered under a rippling canvas roof, the artilleryman leaned back against the muzzle of his mortar and shrugged. The weapon was a 30-inch caliber monster, made possible by the latest casting techniques of the engineering school. Her carriage was muddy from its slow subsidence into the hilltop. The barrel glistened with moisture. From the black feather in the man's cap and the gold trim of his overalls, the sergeant was one of the hundreds on permanent attachment from the Noon regiments. From his nonchalant mien and pox-scarred features, he was a veteran of his fair helping of human misery, and failed to share his general's enthusiasm for more.
"Sigma, may it continue," he stated simply,
voice roughened by powder inhalation and the general moral lassitude of the common born. General von Karlsdorf chose not to respond. It was, he thought, rather chivalrous of him. Matthias Wilhelm was a hawkish man, fleshy in the face and with a congenital bend to his hips that gave him a stoop and a painful awkwardness in the saddle. A burgundy greatcoat fringed with gold hung off his shoulders, and a damp fur callback was pulled down over his ears. A brace of pistols were holstered at his hip, and a Hochland long rifle with a carved walnut stock was bound within a leather sash across his back. For this was how a modern gentleman waged war. At range. The open veldt of the new North Ostermark was a patchwork of dikes, dry stone walls, and the tents and regimental standards of the citizen levies, all in the foothills of a series of massive and wholly artificial earthworks that were a true marvel of the age. Between them, they boasted enough firepower to face down a dragon charge. Together with the mortars here on the hill, the arquebusiers, crossbowmen, and archers camped under the walls and farmsteads, and the almost 4,000 infantrymen picketed on the veldt that had survived the beastmen raids and plague, von Karlsdorff doubted that Archaon ever chosen himself could make it past him to the Empire in one piece. And if the Auric Bastion were to come down anywhere between Rackspire and Beckerfen, then General von Karlsdorff was well prepared for the Chaos Force's inevitable first target, the Standing Stones. The locals called them Dzizi Siostri, or the Three Sisters, for the weather pitting of the three sandstone blocks on its summit did render them vaguely feminine. So not much of a stone circle, then, on any erudite consideration. But then that was Kislev all over. Numerically inferior, semi-barbaric, and womenfolk barely distinct from their men. Well, now Kislev was dead. Long live North Ostermark. The hill on which von Karlsdorff had embedded his prized field pieces and carved out his own command post from the dozen or so other generals that answered to Commandant Rock didn't have a local name, being little more than a shoulder of Dzizi Siostri, raised in a characteristically defeatist shrug. Amongst its imperial occupiers, it had come to be known as Wilhelmshügel. General von Karlsdorff took that as testament to the popularity of his command. He returned his attention to the Three Sisters, wiping condensation from the viewing lens of his eyeglass and then peering through.
"Is it me? Or are they fewer than usual?"
"Conclave with Commandant Rook," supplied the gunnery sergeant.
"Arch-Hierophant Solenbuhr is gone,"
von Karlsdorff mumbled to himself, sweeping the eyeglass along the hill's rugged crown and counting at least a dozen magisters that he could not see.
"Can they carry on with so few?"
The gunnery sergeant did not know, so he did not try to answer. He sucked on his teeth and watched the snow fall.
"General!"
Von Karlsdorff turned as a youngish man in a burgundy bright travelling cloak led his horse through the natural rock barricade and scree that would make Wilhelmshügel such a daunting prospect for an attacker. Breathless from his climb, he passed his reins to an aide before stepping under the thin canvas shelter and shivering sleet water from his doublet.
"Missive from Badenhof, General. Has Rock found where those beastmen are coming from? Just yesterday I lost an entire volley gun crew in Kurzuku."
The general scowled at the memory. The Kislevite village was square in the middle of the imperial formations. It was the centrepiece of the defence between the Auric Bastion and the Three Sisters, and had been heavily refortified around the solid stone hub of the old Ataban's manor. The building had been converted into the most northerly temple of Sigmar in the Empire, and a redoubt bristling with small-calibre demi-cannon. Its extensive wine cellars now stored black powder and grain. Some of the more febrile flagellants camped in Kurzuku even claimed they were connected to a branch of the dwarf underway. But 12 months of idling had not uncovered a hidden entrance, so von Karlsdorff was content to scotch that rumour as hearsay. So how a band of beastmen had managed to get in and kill 5 men there without any of the garrison spotting their approach remained a mystery.
"Not that I know, General. I bring word that General Streichhoff has returned from Altdorf."
"Anything else? Did she bring reinforcements with her, or any word of when we can expect them? I don't care about the Bretonian border, or the Sylvanian front, for that matter. The summer's plague took nearly a quarter of my men."
With a shake of the head, he nodded towards the great mass of infantry camped nearest to the Auric Bastion, beyond the range of all but the largest of the earthworks' great cannon. Campfires winked between the layered curtains of sleet, but otherwise they were as still as freshly turned earth. They were rocksmen, an amalgam of soldiers in the colours of Ostermark, Ostland, and the Southern Oblast, and brought by far the greatest contingent of troops to the field, although none of von Karlsdorff's superior ordnance.
One day, I hope to hear Rock's secret. Forgive me, General, but no. She travels with a Herr Felix Jaeger, whom we were told to expect.
One man? I lose 1,000 without once getting the enemy in range, and Hellborg sends me one man?
Some kind of hero, apparently. Slew a giant in Nuln, or something like that. Oh, very inspiring. He wrote a book about it.
Just what we need,
muttered von Karlsdorff, taking up his eyeglass and dismissing the messenger from his sight before he uttered something uncouth.
A damned writer.
The yard behind Jaeger's of Altdorf was dark. The building was sufficiently large that it blocked out the few mean sources of illumination from the square, and the few structures on the opposite bank of the upper Talabek looked long abandoned. The air tasted damp and raw, and the only sound was the urgent rush of running water, the river tormenting the pilings of a jetty with white foam and freezing spray. An unladen riverboat bobbed on a bed of seething bubbles and pulled on its moorings. On the bank by the jetty, the unsecured corner of a canvas sheet flapped wetly, revealing sack upon sack of grain. From the bitter odour, the weather had soaked through and caused it to spoil. Set back from the water, what looked almost like a rampart of sturdy wooden crates had been thrown up between the river and the back of the house. On the side of the yard nearest the side gate was a stable, occupied by 10 slightly malnourished horses. Something still lived here. Muzzles poked inquisitively from the stalls and snorted hot mist as Felix passed. Without thinking about it, he caught one of the friendly snouts and stroked the horse's chin. It nosed his palm for food, and finding none, pushed it away with a disgruntled snort. This part of the house would have been where tradesmen and servants had come and gone, where Gustav would have taken and stored shipments from Altdorf and elsewhere before sending them on. He turned back to the stables. The horse could have been for transporting goods, or for running messages, or perhaps even for mercenaries on the company's books. Felix didn't really know how to tell the difference. There was one thing, however, that he was growing increasingly sure of. Gustav was here somewhere. It was then that he registered a light. A tiny chink of it streamed through the cracks in a back door. It was what he was currently seeing by. A wooden hammer had been nailed into the doorframe, and a sprig of hawthorn looped around the handle. Felix frowned. It seemed a little peculiar for his modernist nephew Gustav. This door was not barred. He knocked, bringing a drizzle of fine slush from the narrow portico above his head. He hugged himself deeper into his cloak, hunched his shoulders, and shivered against the chill. He waited, counting heartbeats under his breath as the echoes of the knock faded from his mind. No response.
I know you're in there, Gustav, Felix murmured to himself.
The constant rush of water was starting to get on his nerves. An old adventurer's instinct. Anyone could sneak up behind him here, and he'd never hear it over the river. Uneasy, he glanced over his shoulder. Sleet pattered against canvas sheets, the edges rippling in the wind. He forced himself to take a deep breath. He was getting himself worked up over nothing. Turning back to the door, he saw something. The slice of light that shone through the door wavered, just once, as though someone had just passed between the door and their light. Holding his breath, Felix drew an inch of steel from his scabbard and stepped back. His breath clung to his beard as he carefully watched nothing happen. He was beginning to think he'd imagined it, a trick played by his moving head, a stray strand of fringe or a blink at the wrong time. Then it happened again, followed by the iron moan of a withdrawing latch and the slow gape of the door as the wind nudged it open. Light spilled out on a breath of warm, sweaty air. Felix grunted as the light hit his dark-adjusted eyes, watching through narrowed lids as the half-open door swayed back and forth. "Gustav," he said, easing Caragul quietly from its sheath. As blade leading, he shouldered open the door and edged into the house. The floorboards creaked underfoot. The room smelled lived in, of breath and sweat and salted meats. The warmth of a fire brought a shiver. His eyes were still adapting to the brightness, but he had a sense of space, of plastered walls stacked with more goods, and, to his right, a suite of armchairs surrounding a low table. The floorboards gave another groan. Felix froze. He hadn't moved. It had come from his left, just beside the door. Instinct flung him back into the doorframe as a golden blur struck for his chest. His sword rose to meet it, catching it with a clang and driving it up into the lintel. A cultured voice swore lightly, and Felix slid from under the doorframe and backed into the room, trying to put the light behind him. He raised his sword to guard. His eyes throbbed, but he forced them to stay open. His attacker, a painful outline around a red glow, that pulled his sword from the lintel beam and came again. Felix twisted and parried. He couldn't see, but he could do this one-handed in his sleep. A Hengetort guard caught his opponent's blade like a man catching a thrown egg. Then the slightest shift of balance and a push sent the swordsman across his body and into the unchivalrous elbow waiting on the other side. The man, from his strength and the tenor of his voice it was a man, screamed as Felix's elbow cracked his cheekbone and then lashed out with a frenzy of thrusts, slashes and lunging stabs that had Felix falling back. His eyes had recovered enough to glimpse a tall blonde man in light mail and a blue cloak. The other man might have lacked some of Felix's skill, but he was stronger and quicker. His blade, too, was considerably lighter than Caragul, and made sharp, incisive lunges over or under Felix's guard, and it was taking everything he had to keep up. Felix gave ground, too busy to notice the table behind him until his calves were up against it, and his counter to a belly slash sent him crashing into it. Shot glasses shattered underneath him and went tumbling, Felix's sword whipping athwart his chest to intercept a downward stroke. Felix grunted as the swordsman turned his height advantage into weight against the two blades. Inch by inch, Caracul sank until it was at Felix's throat. He'd always thought his end would have more meaning. With a snarl, he kicked out, making a satisfyingly meaty contact with his attacker's groin, and then rolled off the table as the downward pressure on his sword relented. He hit the floorboards in a crunch of shattered glass fragments, clothes sticking to their alcohol glaze as he rolled under it, sword still in hand, to rise on the far side already on guard. His assailant, however, had not got up. The young man lay groaning, slumped up against one of the armchairs with his head on the seat cushion and a rapier loose on the ground a few feet away. The resemblance to a certain roguish ne'er-do-well in his early 20s was striking. The long blonde hair, the sharp blue eyes and hard jaw. All he was missing was the scars. Felix lowered his sword.
"Sigmar's blood, Gustav!"
"Felix," said his nephew, one hand cupping his groin while the other nursed a bruised jaw.
"I was expecting someone else. What are you doing here?" "You called for me, you dolt,"
said Felix, sheathing his sword and trying very hard not to shout.
"Months ago. I thought you weren't coming."
With a piteous moan, Gustav manoeuvred himself up off the floor and into the armchair. Wincing, he fingered his cut cheek.
"Oh, don't be such a child," said Felix, collapsing into a chair of his own. "Women love a scar." "Oh, is that right? Wasn't it Huldalin who gave the classics their first imperfect hero?"
"I wouldn't know," said Gustav snidely. But his fingers treated the scratch Felix had given him with new respect.
"I never read that jingoistic rubbish."
Shaking his head in exasperation, and though he tried to mask it, exhaustion, Felix looked over the room. It looked like an overspill warehouse and smelled like an ale den. Crates had been stacked high and pushed up against the walls. Some made secondary tables, cluttered with weapons and yet more drinking glasses. A few had been wrenched open to spill packing straw and reveal the greenish glimmer of unopened bottles. A fireplace glowed dully in the wall nearest the chairs, and a lantern, turned to its fullest illumination, blazed from the mantel. The two windows were both boarded. By the door, cloaks and weapon belts hung from a row of pegs, enough for 11 or 12 men. Pinned to the neighbouring wall between four knives was a poster that Felix was starting to think would follow him all the way to Kislev. Victory in the North. Someone had scribbled something terribly witty regarding Felix's manhood over the illustration of the Auric Bastion, and some of the text had been charred around a puncture that looked suspiciously like a bullet hole. "That was the staff, not me," said Gustav. "Some of them are remarkably literate for Ostermarkers. They don't approve." Gustav shrugged, then winced, his expression souring further. "I suppose some people just don't like being foisted paper heroes." Felix raised an eyebrow, then shook his head. Sometimes he almost got the impression that Gustav didn't care much for his uncle. Things must have been serious indeed for him to call on Felix for help. "Just tell me what's going on. I might have killed you. Or I might have killed you," Gustav retorted. "I've been practicing since Father sent me north. It's not as if there's much else to do." "Anything's possible, I suppose," said Felix, dropping a pause and inviting Gustav to fill it. His nephew duly obliged. "Rock wants me dead," he said simply, glancing at the open door before rising gingerly to go and close it. He peeked out one last time before resetting the latch and hobbling back to his chair. "I noticed things were off as soon as I arrived. The whole Eastern Front is supplied through this office, but almost nothing we ship out goes where it's supposed to. I had one of our own supply wains followed, and found that it's all just piling up inside Castle Rackspire." Gustav gesticulated to the crate-blocked north wall. "There's 40,000 men across the river, Uncle. Or at least there's meant to be. But what are they eating? How are they keeping warm?" Felix regarded his nephew skeptically. He supposed he should be flattered to find his own example of clueless agitation being so well followed by the next generation of Jaegers. "Other suppliers, perhaps?" Gustav gave a mocking laugh that he wasn't nearly old enough to have earned. "Jaeger and Sons owns this part of the Empire. Grandfather saw to that after the last war. Stockpiles? Loot from the enemy? Or maybe Commandant Rock simply likes to control his own supply chain?" "No, no, and no," Gustav snarled. "I'm being watched, Felix, and I can't leave this house without being followed." "So you stay in the house." Gustav indicated the pile of gear by the door. "After the first few visits from Rock's goons, and particularly after they promised to string me up outside the bathhouse with the beastmen, I decided to hire some mercenaries. They're upstairs." Felix glanced up at the ceiling. "They're not exactly rushing to your defence." As though annoyed by the observation, Gustav ignored it. "Father did ask me to show willing, be patriotic. I thought raising my own free company would kill two birds with one stone." As an unwelcome afterthought, he added, "I'm sure I'll not actually have to do any fighting with them. You've not seen the Auric Bastion. Trust me, nothing's coming through that." "Forget the Auric Bastion," Felix cut in. "I can't believe that this Rock could be, what exactly, running down his own army? Ulrika speaks highly of him."
"You know General Strakov?" asked Gustav, then smiled like a moonstruck young swain.
The look on his face irritated Felix more than it should.
"Old friends."
"She's all right, I suppose."
Gustav gave a ribald chuckle.
"More woman than I'd expect from a horse-loving Kislevite."
"She's at least 20 years too old for you," Felix replied sharply.
"Oh, that kind of friend, is she? How very bohemian of you."
Felix gave his nephew a withering glare, but his wedding ring felt suddenly very tight around his finger.
"She was lying to you, you know."
"She came for help, that's all,"
Felix explained, pushing the memory aside. "A friend of ours was captured when the Chaos forces broke through at Aldefen."
"Another friend?" said Gustav sarcastically. "How many you seem to have collected?"
Felix took a deep breath.
"What can you tell me about Aldefen?"
"Not much. So few of the men sent downriver to oppose them came back. I'll tell you this, though. I hope that friend of yours likes snow, because he's not coming back."
He laughed like a condemned man who'd just seen the man ahead trip on his way to the gallows.
"You don't just walk across the Auric Bastion. It's not some glittering portcullis in the sky that a kindly wizard will raise for you if you ask nicely. It's so high that even the enemy's winged monsters can't cross it. He signed the hammer across his chest, then knocked superstitiously on the tabletop. Pray, Sigmar. Perhaps I should go and see it, Felix mused.
Don't be so brazenly heroic, Uncle. I've just eaten.
Levering himself from the clutches of Gustav's armchair, Felix stood and flexed the stiffness from his muscles. They weren't used to the exertion. Perhaps he should thank Gustav for the warm-up. Smiling at the thought of how well that conversation would go down, he walked to one of the broken crates and took a couple of bottles. The glass was a seaweed green and unlabeled, but judging from the smell that still clung to his cloak after falling in a tableful of the stuff, it was some local variety of pear schnapps. He snuck the two bottles under his arm as he opened the door. He doubted Commandant Rock would miss them, and he'd not been able to enjoy a proper drink since his last night in Altdorf. He sighed. Perhaps it was the young man's resemblance to how Felix still pictured himself. Or maybe it was the thought of Kat, her lie, that he would not have a child to raise in his own likeness. Whatever the reason, he held the door open and turned back. Are you coming? Ulrika's black coach followed the rising trail as it wound into the World's Edge Mountains. The iron-shod wheels broke ruts into brown slush and sent screes scrambling down the scarp to the canopy of spruce that clung to the foothills far, far below. Ulrika listened to the echoes of their fall and to the assurances that Damir muttered like a mantra to the horses. The sky was grey enough that she could travel unveiled and with her curtains drawn, albeit in some discomfort. She could feel the sun behind the clouds, as one would feel a pyre through a blindfold. But it was worth it for the view, which was nothing short of spectacular. The grand might of Ostermark lay before her, a flood of burgundy and gold. She could pick out the stitching of every epaulette and cockade amongst those tens of thousands, but the glorious colour of it all was something she could now only infer from memory and from the dim hues that her inhuman eyes perceived. The army was camped in a rough battle formation around a series of fortified earthworks and the pre-existing creases of the dry stone walls that crisscrossed the veldt of Kislev's southern hinterlands. There were hundreds of regiments down there. Dozens of generals flew their colours over the sleet and mud. Like any honest Kislevite, she had used to joke at the virility of Sigmar's empire. But had someone suggested to her then that the Emperor's poorest province could deploy such a force, she would have laughed twice as hard. At the heart of the aggregated formations was a knoll topped by an ancient-looking henge that her people had called Trizisjostri. The standing stones were cloaked in black soot from the mortars dug into the surrounding hills, the engulfment of the old by the new. Wizards in the robes of the gold and the light colleges held alternate positions within the henge, a circle of men within that circle of stones, hazed by incense and etheric power. Around them, warrior priests and their acolytes chanted in unison with the mages. Like her maker, Adolphus Krieger, Ulrika was master of only the bare rudiments of sorcery. Her new master, however, had encouraged the development of those talents, and through the eyes of her etheric self, she saw the magic drawn from the henge like water from a well. The power of the light brought it from the earth. The alchemy of the gold transformed it, melded it with the incantations of the clergy to turn it into something holy, and sent the product flooding north to the Auric Bastion. Less a wall than a mountain dragged out of the very earth, it was invincible. Even the winds of magic themselves were blocked. The ground before it was bare of snow, and the banners of the Ostermarkers flaccid for want of a breeze from the north. It could not be breached, could not be overflown, and such was its scale that it would have taken a spell.